Okay, you ready to go,
Pat? Yep.
You want me to start out talking?
Yeah.
Back in a little bit, and then you can answer, break in when you want to.
Yeah, okay. Let's start from the very beginning.
Okay. My name is Joseph E. Moeller. I'm 75 years old. My Army serial number was 355-45-102. And I lived in Toledo, Ohio all my life. I was drafted out from here and went out to Camp Perry in January. Got all the dates right here someplace. January, oh boy, okay. Oh, February 8th, 1943, and the dates, and I was discharged in January 6th of 1946. So I just about 3 years.
Did you get
good years and bad years?
Did you get drafted right after high school?
I worked for about a year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and then I went in willingly. It was never, in my time, it was your thing to do. Didn't think anything about it. So, I get upset a lot of times to hear about people today, and like in the Nam War and that, about going for a year. And I couldn't understand it, because in our time I was acquainted with my outfit, and most everybody wanted to be there. It was a thing to do. We just thought not much about it. We had our bad days, and those days we were sorry we were in there, but and not in the end. And to this day, I'm not sorry one little bit for my service. Okay, any other questions there, Andy, along that line?
What was the first thing? Did you go to training camp?
Yeah. We left on a train, didn't even know where we were going. Everything was big secrecy in those times. We went from Toledo to Camp Gordon, Georgia. That's down south, east a little bit of Atlanta, to put in perspective. And we went on a train, and there was a bunch of us. We didn't know where we were going, what we were going to do. We went up down there. It was an artillery camp. There wasn't too many of them, because you have to have a lot of land when you're shooting guns that go 9.5 miles and, you know, the 100-yard killing range. So you've got to be have a lot of space. There was another large artillery camp at Fort Sill, Oklahoma at the same time. But we went to this one. Since the war, Camp Gordon is now Fort Gordon. They made it a permanent. That's different to Army designations. And so now it's a permanent camp. We were down there for our 50th reunion. My outfit has a reunion every year. Of course, there are less guys every year. But we have a good time. We enjoy being together. And it's a big job to get it arranged. If you've got guys coming in, you don't know how many. That's another story. That's not the Army. We went down there to this artillery camp, and we started out our training on 105-millimeter howitzers. And it was quite a job. And then we were there about a year, and then they transferred us into a 75-millimeter pack howitzer. We trained on that. That was a walking outfit. They were small. And so we, what happened here, they would get your training going and so on what they were needed at the time. The war was going on, and they needed certain things. But then it ended up, we went from that to 105-millimeter howitzers, which is a good-sized gun. And it had a range of up to 9.5 miles. We could hit a car at 3 miles without even thinking about it. You know, after you. But of course, you never see what you're shooting at with those kind of guns. It's all by forward observers. There's guys out there that they can see, and they adjust the fire you know, it hits like one spot and it's right. And, oh yeah.
Okay.
And there's calculations you they adjust back. And of course, some guys are better shots than others. Mm-hmm. Our colonel happened to be a hot shot. He could really lay him down. It was not his regular everyday combat job, but boy, if he wanted to, he could get in there, and he was good. We had a great deal of respect for him. That was another thing. Our officers were all, as a general rule, good. We had no big problems. I still see some of them. So then we trained there, and then we went overseas as a 155 howitzer outfit. We departed from Augusta, Georgia, which is the little town at Camp Gordon, and went to, on a train, secret windows pulled, everything, to Boston. And then we got on a ship in Boston. There was about 8,000 to 10,000 guys on it. It was just huge. You ate in shifts. There was people eating all the time. You might have breakfast at 6 o'clock in the morning or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It was just because they were just eating all the time. You'd get on the horn, call out numbers, and you would go and eat. And the food was minimal. Not bad, but just, how do you feed that many guys?
Mm-hmm.
Stew, hash, nothing fancy at all. Eating at stand-up tables, so you didn't have time, so then you could move them out faster.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had landed in Liverpool, England. And that was an experience. We got off the boat there and got on the English trains, and they are small compared to ours, the cars. They would jam you in, and of course you were carrying everything you own. Your two bags and your rifle and everything you own, you had with you, and trying to find a place where that was something sometimes.
So did you have everything issued to you by that time? Like, all your equipment and everything?
Pretty much, correct. The only thing that we got, when we got to England, then they gave us an extra blanket. We didn't need it at that time for the weather, but they knew it was coming up. And then we went there, and we didn't want any train there. We just were waiting in line to get a boat. So we got on a, eventually our turn came up, and we got on an LST, landing ship tank. And one of those was the front end opens. And so we went from there to Omaha Beach. Needless to say, it was not D-Day, thank God, for us. But the ship comes charging up. They get it going as fast as they can, which is not all that fast, because these were just flat-bottom boats with just a lot of men and equipment on it. And they tell you then when you're going to hit, they know. And they have to go in by tides. When the tide was going to be out or going out. And then they told us, because they said, when this hits, you're going to know it. Get out, don't be near a vehicle, or don't be at our guns on there, and they're chained down, but everything moves. And when it hits, it's more than you expected. Everybody gets a real jolt. I remember I went flying. I was hanging onto a stanchion on a beam, but you don't hang on. Then we got out there, went up to, right across the sand, and when we got in there, we were after D-Day, probably 45 days or something, but the harbor or the beach looked like a junkyard. You just couldn't hardly believe the ships. Different kinds I'd never seen before. Airplanes in the water, out of the water. It was just a huge mess, junkyard mess. And then they had the dragon's teeth were up sticking out of the water, and they have to go around in the ship to try to, so you don't get hung up on them, because they had you spotted, the Germans. There was a main observation post at the Omaha Beach where we landed, and I got up in there afterwards, and when you looked out on the ocean or the channel, you could see they had everybody coming in cold. The only thing that made the D-Day work was sheer numbers and the massive equipment. A ship would sink and they'd send another one in. In retrospect, it's kind of scary, because it could have bounced. They could have, and that would have been a big deal. That could push a war back 2 years if they wouldn't have hung on there with their skin of their teeth. to get to make their landing. Then we went on and up through France and worked our way over to, we ended up in Holland, Luxembourg, Germany, of course, through France and Luxembourg. Some of those countries are small when you think you're driving here. Like, if I drive to Florida, over there I could drive through three countries. Because they are so comparatively small. We didn't know sometimes where we were at. Because we just, somebody was giving us grid components and we would just go by the compass. Okay, now we're at there, Andy, and we had done our first hiring. This is all the places we're just, I can't go through all this, but all the places we're at. And the one lieutenant had, from Battery A, had made a combat diary. This is something to read. Really something, because he's got it, not day by day, but pretty much by position. Where we first fired was in Holland, Schinfeld. Schinveld, Holland, our first battery position. And it was, this A battery, that's one battery, in an artillery battalion are three batteries, A, B, and C. Each one has four guns. This happens to be A battery. I got this guy's combat diary here. And they fired from October 22nd to May 2nd, they fired 13,030 rounds around a shell. Incidentally, the shells on a 155mm howitzer weighed 96 pounds each with 100-yard killing range. So you've got four of them, you can pretty well, cover an area.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would have different types of firing. Sometimes we'd be shooting at tanks. Our forward observers call us back. And we also had two Cub airplanes, L-4s. They were little bitty jobs. They would come back with us because guys could shoot under the rifles. The other, the bad guy. And they would come back with bullet holes in the wings and that. And then they would fly over these positions. And then tell where the rounds hit, and then they would send back firing into corrections to make to hit on objects. And sometimes we were shooting at buildings. Churches were church towers. Funny to say, but they were kind of a favorite target of ours because that's where the other guys were.
Mm-hmm.
We were using them when we were going through. So we would knock off those towers and we could do it, with accuracy. Or hit below them and so they put them out of service. Okay, want to take a break here or something? Or what do we got here? What do you want? I mean, just for you, we were kind of fast moving, and you would go from town to town. Sometimes you would set up your guns and would never get to fire. It was a fast moving situation. By the time you got your guns lined in and everything, the Germans were gone, so we'd move again, and usually in the middle of the night, which is real miserable. Because it's hard, you can't see. There's no light, you don't have to drive when you're driving with lights on. It's just little bitty lights. And then there are road markers, guys out at corners signaling where to go, which corners. They string these guys off for miles.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes you get your guns all set, like I said, wouldn't get to fire. And the next time you might get almost overrun by going too far.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the winter, you'd move at night, so at 3 o'clock in the morning, you get off, you get out of the truck, and there you are. You're in the woods. There's snow, 2 foot deep, and that's it. You set up or go to sleep the best you can.
Go to sleep? No. Yeah. Any breaks or?
No. We didn't. Sometimes a division would get 2 or 3 days off. Not much. We didn't. We were what they call corps artillery. 500 people approximately, and then we would get requested for drives, and then they would we would cover them because we could fire, and then we could fire it was different kinds of firing, of course. And then sometimes we would fire 40 rounds at this range. And then if our troops were advancing, then we'd, at this certain time, 6 minutes later, we would raise it 100 yards.
Mm-hmm.
Raising it means we'd go 100 yards farther, and then lay it out again.
Okay.
And boy, that's a lot of steel fire. Plus, it makes the other guys keep their heads down, so they're not as efficient or they're not as ready, theoretically, when you get there.
Pretty loud then, huh?
Oh, yeah, yeah. But I, at the end of the war, I could go down to sleep side of one of these suckers. I could lay down and sleep when they were firing. Because you just, number one, you're tired. And number two, you just get kind of inured to it.
Mm.
You just get kind of, I can do it. Any questions or Andy coming up?
So you did this, or then what happened after?
Well, you're going from battle to battle,
okay,
or from area to area, and then there's a lot of traveling in it, which is kind of tough because you've got these things. We had looked like a tank with the top cut off for they called our prime movers to pull our guns.
Yeah.
It was a track vehicle, and they would they could go through anything or knock down trees, small ones, and go through it pulling the guns. But then, of course, when you got in the winter or rainy weather, it was murder. Because you could our guns are not, 1 5-millimeter howitzer weighs 9.5 ton. And if you get that stucker stuck in the mud up to the axles, then an officer comes out and says, "All right, you guys, move it out." Well, you do. You don't know quite how you did it, but you move it out.
Uh-huh.
And then the slow and the slippery was bad. Because these guns and these half tracks, or these track vehicles, slide like you wouldn't believe. It's like somebody on ice skates. And this, you end up in a ditch with something. You're going to have to dig it out again or build a, we used to call them corduroy roads. Go down and cut down small trees. And just hundreds to make your own road to get out of some of these spots. And they would chew up and then the tanks, and usually you're working with an armored division. Well, they go down on these gravel roads or dirt roads or a macadam road, they just chew it up. It's just a sea of mud. Which, when guys are walking into it, they're up to their knees in the mud, and it's hard walking there.
John,
I
get stuck in the snow.
I did already. It was not unusual to throw on your bedroll in the snow and get some sleep of a kind, and then wake up in the morning and you can't see because you're covered up with snow, and it's kind of a hairy feeling. Everything is hazy. This thing is on. We don't need that in the background.
Is there any, like, remembering any cities or certain battles you really remember?
One of the things I remember was at Aachen. Aachen, that was a forted city. And we didn't spend too much time there because they had to send the troops in. It was a dig them out thing. The infantry, we done a heck of a job in the war. They were the tough guys, really. They were walking. We were riding on a truck or something. And they were walking. And let me see. And then what's the name of the town with the cathedral? We could see it. We could see him up in this church, and it was off limits to shoot at him. That happened not too many times. Historical something?
Sites?
And that only happened twice, I think, as I can remember. And we didn't like it, because we could see him up, we could see our field glasses shining, like you see them in movies or on TV,
mm-hmm.
You know, just a glint. And you know they're out there looking at you. And we could have knocked a tower, those twin towers, we could have knocked them suckers down like nothing. We were good. But we were, I'm trying to find the name of that town. We had a hold off there, and so we sure shot the rest of the town and went through there. Of course, one of the highlights, it was a, March is Battle of the Bulge, which we were totally involved in. And there was times we had these guns would shoot accurately at 8 to 10 miles, and we were what they call direct lay, because we couldn't, it was so screwed up with Germans, and the Fort Observers had no place to go. So we were several times, it was just, it was like aiming a 105 millimeter rifle down the road, the tanks and that, because there was nothing, and it was foggy and snowing and cold. It was terrible, terrible condition. And what you two had trying to do is get the first tank for sure. That screws up the column, and which we had done on several occasions, but suffered a lot of casualties too through that area. Which you kind of take at the time. You always figure, well, I'm glad it's not me. Mm-hmm. But there are so many guys.
Was a lot of people sick?
Not as many as you ever thought. You know, of sick.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you had to be almost bleeding or something off to get off of the line. So we had a doctor,
uh-huh.
And so you go there and a crew of medics, and they would give you aspirin. And you had to be pretty bad off to get out of there. Number one, in our case, most of the guys did not want to go. And so, to get off the line. Because once you got off, went to hospital, you didn't know when or where you would come back. It was very unlikely you would come back to your outfit. You went to a pool. And they were in no position to send here.
Mm-hmm. You didn't get a choice.
No, oh no. So let me see that. We go there. Then we went to Remagen, where the bridge was there, and we were on this side of the river firing for several days. And I went up the hill and looked down at the bridge, and at that time it was not taken. So finally, some GIs got there, and they went there and broke through, and it was in the bridge, because I went down and looked at it. It was all wired and dynamited. Somebody would have got the fuse set off, but somebody either neglected to do it, or it didn't work, or the cord was broke, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So the infantry went across there like gangbusters. Then you had your hands full, because it was unanticipated. We didn't expect the bridge, number one, to be ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have right behind it, though, right behind where we were with these guns, they had pontoon boats and portable bridges.
So who was blowing up the bridge?
The Germans.
The Germans?
Yeah, and somebody blew, as I say, somebody blew it, somebody goofed, because it did not get set off at that time. And we had been bombing it, but obviously no direct hits, the Americans, because it was before we wanted it. Before we got there,
mm-hmm.
We wanted so they couldn't go back over.
Mm-hmm.
So we got there, and then we got down, and it was time to go over. So at that time, they put up two pontoon bridges side of this bridge,
mm-hmm.
because they had to get a bunch of people, when I say a bunch of people, thousands of people, and the equipment, trucks, half tracks, tanks, everything had to go over right oh. now. One bridge couldn't, like this Ludendorff bridge could not, that was a the bridge there. You could not handle that. The volume would put across.
Is that the one in the book?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. By the way, and then we were over there and firing. We had a position. We're just across the river. As soon as we got over there, we spread out our stuff and started firing. Then they had... They were sending airplanes down there. They didn't have many at this point. They would send them down there, a lone bomber or a fighter with the bombs on it, and take a whack at the bridge, because they wanted to screw it up when we were on it, or so we couldn't get any more stuff over. Because we had stuff going across that, the American Army did, 24 hours a day, it just never stopped.
Mm-hmm.
They had lights on the bridge and all that, because it was just go, go. So anyhow, then we were firing on it, and then one day I walked down there to the riverfront. I was talking with my back to the bridge. I was, probably 600 yards, 400 to 600 yards from the bridge with my back to it. And this guy, I was talking to the guy in an anti-aircraft battery. They had them all set up along there trying to shoot down these planes that were coming over trying to blow up the bridge. And this guy just pointed, and his mouth fell open. I turned around, and the bridge was in the process of going down. It had not been hit direct on the day it went down, but it had been hit before. And then the American Army had caught some, they were sending scuba divers down the river with charges and that there, trying to get by under cover of darkness. But they had lines set up along the river on these, they had pontoon bridges, which our outfit went over the pontoon bridge, which is kind of hairy. Because these, like I said, these guns, we were our 2.5-ton trucks, and these guns weighed 9.5 ton each, and that bridge was just like, I want to say bubbling, it was just rolling all the time, and you felt like, and I often wondered, what would have happened if that would have broke through for better loot, you'd have been done. We wouldn't have no life preserve, none. We were just going. But you didn't think about those things. I thought about it afterwards, not at the time. Then we had a breakout from our position there at Remagen, which was this town, and we would come out here, and then there was a big wide open space, and so we had to get our whole outfit across, which was 100 vehicles all together with mm-hmm. the jeeps and everything and the ambulance. And so, but then they had that spotted. The Germans could hit that road at a couple spots anytime they wanted to, by a burned out tank or something, which would be their aiming point. By the way, now, in our guns too, we would register a lot of times like on a point during the day, and we could hit it at close to it. Then at night, we had taken down all those figures. Then at 3 o'clock in the morning, when our forward observers would hear stuff going through there, a convoy, a German convoy or something, and we would open fire on that sucker. And could we done much damage like that, we could just tear up a crossroads. Of course, when you have 12 guns with the, you know, that capacity, and you can shoot them all.
Did they have a certain name for the roads, the hedgerows? Or
Hedgerow fighting in France was done when we got there.
Oh, okay.
That was, we had been through them. And it was kind of almost like an impossible situation. I often wondered just how in hell those guys got through there, did that.
So they're totally demolished,
yeah.
Tore up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Then we got to the Maginot Line. It was a Frenchman, only the Germans that used it now. So they had crews would go ahead, and there was every so often there was pillboxes, and then they all intersecting fire, and then they had a door every so often for the guys to get in. So the Americans would send their crew around, weld the door shut, real quick, and then you can go around the front and throw something in the slot, crawl over. And then sometimes they'd just send a bulldozer out. They had tanks rigged up with bulldozers on the front. And they would go out and fill up, cover up the slats, and weld the back door shut and just leave.
So they're stuck?
Yeah, for a long time. And of course it was like in the combat time, there was every day there was a new problem or something going on. And all this time here, and of course with these guns, these projectiles, we didn't have particularly an ammunition shortage. We had ammunition shortage of getting it to the guns. We wouldn't get it. We wouldn't have ammunition. There was a couple times we were out, and we'd have to ration it, if you can imagine. You know, 5 rounds a day or something like that. Well, God, we could shoot probably 5 rounds in 3 minutes. But that's all part of the different stories. And the food was always, you always had food.
Mm-hmm.
It always wasn't very good because we ate a lot of sea rations. and a basic that was stew and hash, which both were Shakespeare like, and then you just eat them in little tin cans.
What is that like?
It's like meat and vegetables chopped up.
Oh, okay, yeah, in a can.
Yeah, in a can. You get two cans. You get one can of food, and the other can you get was the same size, and you open that up, and there's a pack of cigarettes. Well, it was four packs, like, it was like the sample packs. You probably haven't seen them, younger people. A little bit of pack of matches, three or four pieces of hard candy, some hard biscuits, hard cookies, biscuits, unsalted, and then either coffee in an envelope, coffee or lemonade, which were both marginal, but there were times you were darn glad to have it. But they had cigarettes every day, and then, of course, as the war went on, that's been a big argument today, there would be hundreds of cartons of cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
They would do it, and they would up in the mess hall, so if you wanted a carton of cigarettes, or you wanted three cartons, you just go up and get them. They were always there, which, of course,